And now for something completely different. I'm going to be reading from The Nuptial Mystery by Angelo Cardinal Scola, which is published, somewhat unfortunately, very recently by Erdmann's Press, which means that by reading this I will be breaking the law. And I just want anybody from Erdmann's to know that I will happily withdraw this podcast at your request. I understand that it's illegal, but I think that you might also think it okay if I'm doing this for just a small group of friends. And it's sort of like reading aloud to several friends gathered around the room. So, I'm skipping some sections and reading from page 6, section 1.2, The Anthropological Foundation, The Dual Unity of Man and Woman. And I think it'll quickly become self-explanatory what we're talking about. One of the preeminent aspects of the anthropology implied in John Paul II's teaching consists in his reflection on the relation between man and woman. The Pope begins with a series of considerations on the two accounts of creation in Genesis, which converge in the affirmation that man is made in the image and likeness of God, an affirmation the Holy Father calls the basis of all Christian anthropology. Mulieris Dignitatem asserts in section 7 that man cannot exist alone. He can exist only as a unity of the two, and therefore in relation to another human person. Being a human person in the image and likeness of God thus also involves existing in a relationship, in relationship to the other I. The man-woman pair appears in this way to be the expression of the ontological principle of dual unity, according to which unity always presents itself in a contingent reality within an intrinsic polarity. This also holds true for soul and body and individual and community. We limit ourselves to itemizing, almost by a list of headings, four essential features of the meaning of the man-woman pair. A. Man exists always and only as a masculine or feminine being. There is not a single man or woman who can by himself alone be the whole of man. He always has before himself the other way of being human, which is to him inaccessible. In this way, we discover in the relation of man and woman the contingent character of the human creature. The I needs the other, and depends upon the other for his fulfillment. The duality of masculine and feminine gender, in quotes, thus presents itself at once as internal and external to the I. Or rather, the I registers a lack within himself that opens him to one outside of himself. It is in this context that the reflection on the principle of a helpmate, understood not unilaterally but reciprocally, arises. This contingence identifies not only man's limits, but also his capacity for self-transcendence in the discovery of the other than himself as positive for himself. In this sense, contingence reveals that man, like every creature, is a sign. He is not only an individual, identity, but also a person, relation, difference. Accordingly, the Pope says, being a person in the image and likeness of God thus also involves existing in relationship to the other I. B. At the same time, we can characterize the relationship between masculine and feminine as a relation of identity and difference. Okay, now I'm reading with Augustine, my son, on my lap. So, if there are any strange noises, it's him. The question of identity is easily traced back to the absolute equality of the two, of man and woman, in their being as persons and in everything that derives from this. The conciliar text constantly recalled by the Pope to illustrate this claim is taken from the Constitution Gaudium et Spes. If man is the only creature on earth whom God has desired for its own sake, man can fully discover his true self only in a sincere giving of himself. In this sense, the Pope joins with the Western philosophical tradition expressed in the definition of Boethius, Persona est naturae rationalis individua substantia. A person is an individual substance of a rational nature. The question about difference is more complicated. In fact, to think about sexual difference is the very thing that appears problematic today. In any case, sexual difference is not reducible simply to a problem of roles. It must be understood ontologically. Dual unity, in this sense, is a phenomenological sign of that which Thomas called the distinctio realis, and Heidegger, ontological difference. Even in the relation of man and woman, as in the relation between being and ends, is expressed the call of being, addressed through reality, which is its sign, to human freedom. It is for this reason that the dual unity of sexual difference does not mean an irenic and symmetrical reciprocity, as Aristophanes supposed in Plato's Symposium. Man and woman are not two halves destined to merge so as to regenerate a lost unity. This is evident even at the phenomenological level of the states of life. Man lives relations not only of a spousal sort, but also of paternity, maternity, fraternity, etc. On the other hand, the reciprocity of man and woman can stand as a paradigm of that community dimension which characterizes man's entire nature. There is another aspect linked to the question of sexual difference that we cannot fail to mention. I am referring to how it is that dual unity inevitably imposes an ulterior and more acute awareness of one's own original dependence. By virtue of his sexual nature, in fact, man discovers death as mediated through his connection with generation. Dual unity places the I within the circle of human generations, which follow one upon the other relentlessly. In this way, the species itself is preserved, but the individual is exposed to death. C. From a more theological point of view, human sexuality, and therefore the difference of the sexes, belongs to man's being as image of God. This statement helps us avoid, in any attempt to define the human being, every move to confine him within the intracosmic, and thereby to reduce sexuality to the level of animality. On the other hand, sexual difference helps us understand that the image cannot be reduced to some purely spiritual element. Moreover, the inclusion of sexual difference in the Imago Dei allows us to speak, under precise conditions to be sure, of a certain analogy between the relation of man and woman and the Trinitarian relations. Communio, as an essential dimension of man, is part of his being in the image of God. D. What we have said thus far allows us to see in spousal love the analogatum princeps of every kind of love, and at the same time to consider it a privileged metaphor for man's relation with reality. On this subject, the Pope affirms, "The nature of one and the other love, virginity and marriage, is conjugal, that is, expressed through the total gift of oneself. Both types of love tend to express that conjugal meaning of the body, which from the beginning has been inscribed in the personal makeup of man and woman." These four elements, which characterize the meaning of the relation of man and woman, allow us to conclude that sexuality is an original and not derivative dimension of man. One cannot construct an anthropology apart from the human being's sexual nature. Were sexual difference not essential to the consideration of the person, the relation to the other would be established independent of such difference. Sexuality, in that case, would be a purely accidental fact. Does not this sort of disincarnate anthropology, so to speak, end in a negation of the woman as a personal subject of desire, with the risk of reducing her purely to an object of masculine desire? Similarly, any position that understands the personal dignity of the woman not as its essential premise, but rather only as one of its consequences, would end up compromising the value of maternity and virginity. The affirmation of human sexuality as an integral part of the Imago Dei as we have said above, also allows us to establish a radical differentiation of human sexuality from animal sexuality, with which it obviously maintains solid bio-instinctual connections. Against every Gnostic temptation, we must affirm the fully human, that is, personal character of sexuality. In this sense, the body expresses the person, and expresses it even in its being masculine and feminine. Every attack upon the dignity of the body, and here, unfortunately, the woman is more exposed than the man, is an attack upon the dignity of the person. Another consequence of this conception of the dual unity is the radical elimination of every exclusionary contraposition between man and woman. Rather, only in their reciprocal dependence is their personal character fulfilled. This implies the simultaneous affirmation of their identity and difference. The exclusive exaltation of one of the poles over the other cannot help but rupture the original dual unity willed by the Creator. Therefore, it will not be possible to promote the dignity and the rights of women if this characteristic is not respected. On the other hand, it is obvious that every form of chauvinism contradicts the creative design. Thus, the fact that the current debate on the question of women is poised in terms of reciprocity, having evolved from its earlier forms of emancipation and separation, is something positive. Without entering here into the merits of particular questions, it is beyond all doubt that the search for equality, or as we would prefer to say, for identity, with respect to sexual difference or diversity, better corresponds to the Christian vision of life. The work in favor of the dignity and mission of women in the church and in the world can be eminently creative by defending all dimensions of the woman's being, those she shares with the man by virtue of their common identity, and those proper to her by virtue of her being a woman.